This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Alex Smith, and I'm telling you, the world media is asleep, drugged into Trump and Trump investigations, lost in meaningless entertainment babble, while endlessly selling you very dangerous products. Here is the real story. Humans have already driven Earth's climate into a new state. The atmosphere has filled with greenhouse gases, acting like a blanket, with heating that can no longer be stopped. The melting poles are just the beginning. If you are a regular Radio EcoShock listener, you probably know that already, from the many scientists, hundreds now, that I've interviewed for you. Maybe it's hard to be surprised, but I'm shocked by countless signs that we are already entering the extreme danger zone. Let me give you just one example. Record high temperatures, lasting longer than usual, are slamming the northern hemisphere. I've already talked to you about high temperatures in Pakistan and India and Vietnam, but this is a little closer to home for many of you. Yes, it's the start of summer. Summers are hot. But in the 27 years of monitoring climate news that I've done, I've never seen a collection of heat reports as came in this past week. In the United Kingdom, that place surrounded by cooling oceans, temperatures of 91.5 degrees, melted roads there, that's hot for the UK. Health officials warned young kids who have less bodily heat control than adults, and seniors who die in great numbers during extreme heat events, they warned them to take shelter. And then it got hotter. In London, ambulance calls went up 46% as temperatures there reached 35.4 degrees C, or almost 96 degrees. Most people in the UK do not expect such heat and do not have air conditioning. The science blog phys.org writes about the heat wave all over Europe from London to Siberia. There have been heat deaths already in California and New Mexico. You know some flights out of Phoenix, Arizona were canceled because the heat was too hot for some planes to fly. There were three record hot days in Phoenix, reaching 117 degrees Fahrenheit on June 20th, which is over 47 degrees C. The overnight low, and this is key for human survival, was over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or 32 degrees C. That's relentless heat. In perfect timing, our Radio EcoShock guest recently, Camilo Mora of the University of Hawaii, with 17 other scientists from several countries, published a new study in the journal Nature Climate Change. The title is Global Risk of Deadly Heat. And Camilo says, I can't understand why people aren't more worried about this. I mean, America's going to turn into abysmal heat. Seth Borenstein, the reliable reporter from Associated Press, gives it this headline, Too Hot to Handle. Study shows Earth's killer heat worsens. The study says 20% of humans already experience 20 days a year of deadly heat. By the end of this century, unless dramatic action intervenes, 3 out of 4 humans will live or die through that kind of heat. It's planetary heating. Let's call it, global warming. I'm calling it. The heat is here. We may have some cooler years, some crazy cold snaps to bring the deniers out of their cozy homes and offices. But from this time on out, we'll get more and more heat waves, lasting longer, with hotter nights, less ice, and less chance to save ourselves from outright climate catastrophe. Did the Russians interfere with the American elections? Our first guest this week will explain how monumental and lethal all human intervention in the climate has been. Clive Hamilton talks about his new book, Defiant Earth. Then we'll go to what you might call a lesser story. The nuclear industry and their captured regulators in America have decided it's not worth a few million dollars to prevent the evacuation and possible permanent evacuation of places like New York, Baltimore, where millions and millions of Americans live. That's a story repeated wherever there is a nuclear power plant near a big population center. And it's not just the known and demonstrated risk in Russia, Japan, of a nuclear reactor meltdown. No, it's the vast collections of nuclear fuel accumulating in poorly protected pools. And this isn't news to terrorists. They already know. They've already been thinking about it. The legendary Frank von Hippel from Princeton tells you the awful truth.
Radio EcoShock.
We've just had major, major heat waves in most parts of the Northern Hemisphere. It's not just the Middle East and Pakistan where you might expect it. It's New York, London, Paris, and Los Angeles sweltering under road-melting temperatures. But that's just the 30-second weather report, isn't it? The rest of the news goes on as though we haven't changed the climate or gone off course. 3 years ago, I talked with Clive Hamilton about his book Earth Masters, The Humans Who Want to Control the Climate with Geoengineering. Now this leading Australian intellectual is back with even worse news. The future is stranger than anyone thinks. He's captured all that in a new book titled Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. That's your fate in the new time. Dr. Hamilton has lectured at Yale, Oxford, and Cambridge. He's been the executive director of the Australia Institute and longtime professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra, Australia. From Canberra, Clive, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's good to be back, Alex.
What do you make of the extreme weather that has arrived way sooner than many scientists predicted? Are we in a climate shift already?
I think there's no doubt about that. The climate system of the Earth is now starting to function in a different way. As one climate scientist put it, the old rules that govern the Earth's dynamics are now changing, and we're having trouble anticipating what's going to come. But we do know for sure that it's going to get hotter, the climate system is more energetic, and that will bring more extreme events like cyclones, heat waves, droughts, and so on.
In the United States, and to some degree in your own Australia, people trying to survive ungodly heat or flooded out by unheard-of dumps of rain, they still manage to vote for climate deniers. How is that possible?
It's an astonishing insight into the delusory capacities of the human psyche. After all, the best scientists in the world have been warning us for some 25 years now that we're headed into dark times, hot times, and yet somehow most people find a way to, if not outright deny what the climate scientists are saying, to nevertheless downplay it, avoid it, evade it, put it in another box, pretend that, well, maybe they're exaggerating, or some technology will come along, and after all, aren't there other scientists saying that it's all exaggerated? So we grasp at straws, don't we? And, you know, we need to be, in a way, I've become kind of more forgiving because, you know, well-meaning, reasonably well-informed people I know, yes, they accept the science. Yes, they think we need to do something about climate change, but really it's way down their list of priorities. But if you listen to what the scientists are telling us, what could be a higher priority than protecting the livability of planet Earth?
I have to admit, I had a hard time reading your book, Defiant Earth. And, you know, I mean, there's no throwaway pages here. There's no throwaway sentences. It's really packed. And some sentence would send me past, oh, God, that's true, into a temporary brain melt. I have to go away and think about it. It's just not easy to understand where we are, is it?
I wrote this book because climate scientists, or rather Earth system scientists, there's quite a lot of overlap there, but Earth system scientists are telling us something kind of bigger and more confronting than the science of climate change. They've recently started to tell us that the Earth system, that is the totality of the Earth from its core out through the atmosphere to the moon, has entered into a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, the age of humans. So just stop and think about that. What they're saying is that human impact on nature has now become so large and powerful that we rival the great forces of nature on the functioning of the Earth system as a whole. Wow, we have become a geological force. And that to a significant degree, the future evolution of the planet, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of years here, is now in our hands. We've knocked it off its course and there's no going back. But in the next decades, we will decide collectively, or at least the powers that be will decide, under the influence in democratic countries of the citizenry, whether we knock it much further off course and send the Earth spinning into an extremely chaotic, dangerous, and potentially existential phase of its development. So we have now entered into deep time. That is, the 4.5 billion year history of the Earth is divided up into a whole range of epochs and eras and ages and so on, the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, and so on. What the scientists are now telling us is that we have entered into a new epoch, the Anthropocene, determined by human impact. And this has happened only in the last decades. This is a very, very profound thing that's very hard to get your head around. In fact, I think it will take us years to really understand what the meaning of this new epoch is.
Yeah, I read you saying that the whole 9 billion years time that this planet is expected to live has been split into halves before humans and after humans, and I had an internal objection. I mean, it makes us sound like the new gods on the block. Isn't that overreaching a bit?
Well, what do gods do? Among many other things, and we're kind of speaking literally if that's your way of thinking, or metaphorically if you're not religiously inclined, I mean, powerful gods determine the future of the Earth, the shape of the Earth, how it changes, how it evolves. And what the Earth system scientists are telling us is that's what we're now doing. So it seems to me that we really have to face up to this kind of astonishing fact. Much as we may hate it and find it difficult to swallow, the truth is that humans have become powerful beyond any previous imagining. We are now powerful enough to change the geological future of the Earth. So the question that screams out at us is this: how can we own up to the truth of this extraordinary power and take ownership of it without succumbing to the narcissism and the Promethean delusions of grandeur that got us into this impossible situation in the first place? To me, this is the fundamental question. How do we own up to the truth of what the Earth system scientists are telling us about our astonishing technological power, and yet not continue to abuse it and send the Earth off into such a disastrous place that many forms of life can't survive?
Well, I guess the good news and the bad news is we may have delayed the next ice age.
This is one of those facts that I like to use because it illustrates this point so powerfully. Geologists can now predict with a pretty good degree of accuracy when the next ice age will come. And ice ages are determined, and indeed warming periods, by how much solar radiation reaches the Earth. And the Earth has a number of cycles. It wobbles around its axis. The axis changes its tilt. You know, we're talking over periods of thousands of years. And the orbit of the Earth around the Sun varies from pretty much circular to somewhat elliptical. And all of these affect the amount of solar radiation heating the planet. And on this basis, they can calculate that the next ice age is due in around about 50,000 years' time. But the confronting fact is that they're also telling us that because of warming that human beings have brought about on the Earth, much of which is now locked in, and more warming which will inevitably occur, will definitely go beyond 2 degrees, probably 3 to 4. That amount of warming, which will last such a long time, will actually suppress the next ice age in 50,000 years' time. And if we don't do a lot more in the next 2-3 decades, it may well suppress the subsequent ice age, which is due in 130,000 years' time. So these facts tell us just how enduring the human impact on the planet is. And, you know, some people might say, well, hey, who wants another ice age? I don't like the sound of that. Well, I say, rather than warm the planet in an intolerable way for 50,000 years, how about you come back in to me in 49,000 years' time and say, hey, we're expecting an ice age in about several centuries. Let's start thinking about what we might do.
Good plan. You know, I've got a bit of confusion. What is the difference between the Great Acceleration and the Anthropocene, or is there a difference?
Yes, there is. The Great Acceleration is the term used by Earth system scientists like Will Steffen and Jan Zalasa, which to describe the really extraordinary takeoff after the end of the Second World War. So from kind of the late 40s, early 1950s, in global resource use, population growth, waste generation, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, resource use, land use, fossil fuel consumption, mineral use, and so on. If you look at a whole range of those over a long period of time, you see that after the end of the Second World War, they suddenly took off and accelerated. And so they call that the Great Acceleration. And they've decided, the Earth system scientists now, you know, many of the leading ones now meeting in what's known as the Anthropocene Working Group, which is the official body tasked with gathering the evidence to make the case for a new geological epoch called the Anthropocene. Those scientists say, in our best judgment, the new epoch, the Anthropocene, started after the Second World War as a result of the Great Acceleration.
And you write, they prognosticate about a future from which the dominant facts have been expunged, futurologists trapped in an obsolete past. It is the great silence. Who are you talking about?
Well, if you walk into a bookshop, a good bookshop, you'll go to sections which are about the future of the world, our futurologists, our kind of great thinkers who are prognosticating about what the 21st century will look like. One name that comes to mind, Steven Pinker, for instance, but there are plenty of others. You can see them all over the place. And if you open them up and look at the table of contents or go to the index, you'll find no mention or virtually no mention of climate change whatever. And so it's as if they live in another world, one where the science of climate change, let alone the Anthropocene, doesn't exist. It's as though, well, you know, we'll leave the science to the scientists, but, you know, it's not really within our intellectual universe. So we'll talk about, you know, the clash of civilizations and future technological singularities and this kind of thing, as if the scientists don't exist. I mean, these are, you know, the greatest intellectuals in the world, and yet they are in denial. I just find this astonishing. I think our intellectuals are really failing us very badly indeed, because if the great and good at Harvard and Princeton and Cambridge are not deeply engaged with climate change and the kind of earth, the kind of world, the kind of international community that is likely to create, then they don't understand what the future is.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My guest is the well-known Australian academic, Dr. Clive Hamilton. Clive wrote or co-authored books like Growth Fetish, Affluenza, and Requiem for a Species. We're talking about his latest, Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. Now, your previous book, Earth Masters, exposed the dubious ideas behind trying to fix the damage from technology with more technology. But I gather the whole concept of geoengineering is getting outmoded, being based on some sort of classical Earth and not the new Earth systems we've created. Is that what you're saying?
In my earlier book, Earth Masters, I made the point that under the impact of human-induced climate change, the Earth system is moving into a new phase, as some of the Earth system scientists have described it. We are entering into a no-analog state. In other words, nothing like this has happened before. The Earth is becoming, the climate system is becoming more energetic, as they put it, more energy in the system. And that means that it's becoming more chaotic in its behavior, more unpredictable, and of course more uncontrollable. And climate scientists and Earth system scientists use metaphors to try to communicate to us what this means. James Lovelock, for example, famously talks about the revenge of Gaia, and we have Earth system scientists talking about the waking giant and Arctic death spirals to try to communicate to us that the Earth is no longer the passive, submissive, entity that we thought it was. Whether we were either on the Promethean side, well, there it is, we'll go and exploit it and rip what we want out of it, and we'll, that's what our right, and you know, who's going to object? Or even the environmentalists, you know, my tribe, if you like, who have traditionally regarded the Earth as kind of Mother Earth, passive, submissive, whom we're raping and pillaging. No, Earth is no longer like that. That was the Earth perhaps in the Holocene before we entered into the Anthropocene. But in the Anthropocene, the Earth is an angry beast. And to the idea that we should use our technology, having poked and prodded and provoked this beast into waking up, which is now raging around, that we can now use our technology to try to pacify it, to drug it, to quiet it down, I think is an extremely dangerous approach. And we have enormous power, and we can't repudiate that. What we have to do is to learn to use it meekly, if you like, humbly, responsibly, without running away from it.
And I also have the concern that planners, including some top scientists and almost every politician, assume that our economy will continue despite hit after hit from a destabilized atmosphere, the rising seas and all that. It's like the Stern Report. Here's a 5% cost for addressing climate change or something. What do you think? Can we just keep the economy rolling along despite all this that's happening?
Well, there are kind of two possibly contradictory answers here. One is, the economists have argued that the sensible ones, not the apologists for the fossil fuel industries, that the technologies to replace fossil fuel-based energy are there, available, and not only will they be cheaper, in many places they already are. Here in Australia, for example, it's universally agreed, except perhaps by the coal industry, and even they now have trouble defending their view. It's universally agreed that building solar plants and wind farms will generate cheaper electricity than building new coal-fired power plants. On the other hand, when we look at how the Earth is starting to change in response to warming, and bear in mind the Earth is on average warmer by 1.1 degree, although much more in the Arctic, and I'm completely freaked out about what's happening in the Arctic, and we will definitely warm by twice as much as 1.1 degrees. Look how much trouble we're in now, how much more we're going to get. So how can an economy, the current system, given that it's produced this unfolding disaster, how can it survive? How can it cope? There are people out there, environmentalists, conservative environmentalists, who call themselves eco-modernists, and they're particularly gathered around a think tank known as the Breakthrough Institute in San Francisco. They argue that there's no problem with the system. Our technology-based, profit-oriented capitalist system may have produced a bit of a problem, but hey, it's endlessly inventive, creative, and can tackle any problem, and it will tackle this. So what we need is more technology, more capitalism. And I think this is an extremely dangerous argument. And perhaps there are some people in some countries starting to wake up to this. I mean, look at the kind of support that Bernie Sanders got, who declared himself to be a socialist in the United States. And then Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, who adopted a very progressive social democratic agenda. And so now we have a kind of, we're on the cusp of the turning of the neoliberal revolution, which ought to empower brave politicians to challenge some of the fundamentals of the neoliberal capitalist order.
So, how are climate politics going in Australia these days?
Oh, Alex, do you want the long and depressing answer or the short and depressing answer? We now have a Prime Minister who of our Conservative Party, which oddly is known as the Liberal Party, Malcolm Turnbull, who once said that I will never lead a Liberal Party that doesn't share the same commitment to climate change as I do. And he was seen as the kind of great white hope of conservative politics among those who take climate science seriously. But when he was elevated to the Prime Ministership, replacing an out-and-out climate science denier in the form of Tony Abbott, suddenly Turnbull found that the forces of darkness, of denial of the fossil fuel industry, the fearful men and women who can't tolerate change, who loathe environmentalism, they got their claws into him. And we saw this man, Malcolm Turnbull, so committed to doing something on climate change, become gradually hollowed out, become the captive of the troglodytes, so that a few months ago he started to argue what we need in Australia is a new generation of coal-fired power plants.
Oh, that sounds so familiar. You know, we'll bring back those coal mining jobs, as Trump says. You know, I was kind of caught in that regard by your later quote in the book from Napoleon saying, "Politics is fate." What does that mean?
Well, I love this quote. You can read a lot of meanings into it. The kind of meaning I was putting into it in the book is this idea that although there's something happening in the Anthropocene at the grand level of humankind and the earth, of deep history and dramatic change, if we're going to think about what to do, the answer is always political. The only answer is politics, and our fate, therefore, and indeed the fate of the earth, lies in the hands of political action. And while we're on the question of fate, which I put into the subtitle of the book, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene, I was very struck by a sentence in a scientific article, a number of Earth system scientists who are talking about the impact of humankind on the geological evolution of the Earth and, of course, the way in which the changing functioning of the Earth system under the impacts of climate change, but also other system-wide environmental change. They said of humans and of the Earth, the fate of one determines the fate of the other. And I thought, wow, I mean, that is just so powerful if you start thinking about it over the kind of stretch of big time and big history. But in the end, whatever change comes about as a result of human life on Earth, it will come about not through individual action, not by, you know, conscious consumerism, not by sitting back and hoping that some brilliant mind will invent a new technology that will come along and save us. It will be through politics that the Earth will evolve.
I'm personally not so sure about that. I think that some individual actions and societies changing away almost from the political system, unseen perhaps, you know, as more people grow their own food, go local, do all these small-scale changes that aren't as visible on the federal level. But you also say, and you talked about this earlier, that our choices are either to go for more control, call it geoengineering or climate engineering or whatever, or, and this is a tough one, to practice meekness. I'm wondering if practice meekness might need to be your next book. What does it mean?
Well, let me point out one thing it doesn't mean. It does not mean that we can kind of withdraw from the world, repudiate technology, and, you know, in the old enviro phrase, walk more lightly on the earth. I mean, I think, of course, we do have to walk more lightly on the earth, but the fundamental point about the Anthropocene is that we can't walk away from it. We have shifted the functioning of the earth system in a way that is now irreversible, because the earth has now, the rules have changed. We have changed the rules of the way the earth functions in ways that some ways we do understand. It's getting hotter. We're going to have more extreme weather events, but also in ways that are very hard to predict. So we can't turn back the geological clock from the Anthropocene, which we've now entered, into the previous kind of golden era of the Holocene, where for 10,000 years, the Earth went into this extraordinarily and unusual period of stability and clemency of the weather, so stable and clement that it allowed civilization to develop. Now we've changed all of that, and we can't just say, oops, stop, 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 we'll go back to the Holocene, because we've set the Earth on a different path. What we have to now do is to manage that, to cope with it, to deal with it. I hope that we do it, that we approach that task with an attitude of meekness, of humility, but not without repudiating the incredible power that we have. You see what I mean? How do we take responsibility for this power? Do we do it with great humility and care, or do we do it with a kind of Promethean aggression, a kind of Donald Trump, you know, we can crash through and use our power to subdue the earth? If we try that, we are screwed, and many life forms are screwed. So that's what I'm saying. We have to try this seemingly impossible task of owning up to our power, not running away from it, but using it in a way that minimizes the damage and adapts in a way over the next centuries in a way that is as just and fair and reasonable and respectful of life as we possibly can.
As we wrap up here, Clive Hamilton, is there anything else you would like to talk about with our listeners?
Let me just say one thing, Alex. It's been a kind of fascinating project writing this book, and I've kept just kind of shifting my views of I've understood more, maybe understood less, some readers might think. But some readers, I'm not a Christian or a person with any particular religious orientation, but I know that one or two people who are theologians who read the book in draft saw in it some very powerful theological themes. And I can see what they mean, because it really is about the place of humans on this earth. It is about human fate and how the gods, if I can put it that way, might be looking down on this powerful, errant, but special creature on the earth, and our mistakes, and how they should regard us, whether we deserve saving, whether there is some kind of hope that we can invest some faith in. These kinds of questions come up right through the book, so that people who do have a theological orientation found themselves stopping and thinking about it in the way they think about human beings and our existence on earth. So I found that extremely interesting. So it definitely has a kind of theological resonance for people who are attuned that way.
Well, Clive, I have to admit, I haven't quite finished your book, and it's your fault because you keep sending me away to think. You know, I hope it turns out well.
Thanks, Alex.
I'll put links to today's discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, and also my previous interview with Clive in May 2013. By all means, get Clive's tweets at Clive C. Hamilton, and visit his website at clivehamilton.com. His latest brain-bending book is Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. Clive, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. I always enjoy talking with you.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Americans are not protected from a catastrophic nuclear waste fire at many reactor sites. The fallout from radioactive fuel could be huge, much larger than from the 2011 Fukushima reactor accident in Japan. Millions of people would be exposed to radioactive particles. There could be forced mass and possibly permanent evacuations of major U.S. cities. Taxpayers could be forced to pay trillions for damages and decontamination efforts. That's all in a new article published in the May 26th issue of Science magazine. The report comes from researchers at Princeton University and the Union of Concerned Scientists. Our guest, Frank von Hippel, is a co-author of this warning. He's a senior research physicist at Princeton's Program on Science and Global Security. That is based at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Dr. von Hippel is the author of several books. He has advised governments in the past. He has a thorough background in the physics of atomic affairs. Dr. von Hippel, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Was there a fire in the fuel pools during the 2011 nuclear accident at Fukushima, Japan?
There was not. The water level fell in the pool of unit number 4, but it didn't uncover the spent fuel, and therefore we didn't have the scenario in which the radioactive heat in the fuel would have heated it up to a temperature where the metal cladding, the zirconium cladding on the fuel, would have caught fire.
It was so hard to get reliable information about what happened at Fukushima, especially at Reactor 4, where the building was unstable, and Reactor 3, which was burning and storing plutonium-laced fuel. I guess the Japanese government was trying to control public fear, and U.S. regulators weren't saying much either. Frank, I'm concerned if an accident happens in the States, the public won't get good and timely information for the same reasons. What do you think?
Well, actually, in the case of the Fukushima, U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission was convinced that there was a fire going in pool number 4 for about a week or two after the earthquake, and so their information wasn't very good either. I think they don't cover up. I mean, in Japan, there is a history of cover-ups, but not so much in the U.S. The problem really is the confusion. I go back far enough. I remember Three Mile Island when there was a huge fear that there was going to be an explosion in the reactor. It turned out to be an unfounded fear. But there is a lot of confusion at a time of a nuclear accident.
Well, that's partly because you can't really get to the site. It's too dangerous to go there, and so you can fly over maybe, and even that's dangerous.
That's right. In fact, the hint that we got that maybe there was water in pool number 4 after all was a reflection that somebody in a helicopter thought they saw through a hole that had been blown in the building by a hydrogen explosion.
Now, following the Fukushima accident, and particularly the problems with spent fuel, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission promised to take action to avoid similar risks in America. What action has been taken that you know of?
Well, there was a whole list of possible actions that they considered. And some they took, like having available emergency equipment, pumping equipment, in case the power went out on the regular equipment in the reactor, as it did in Fukushima. But the action that they considered but decided not to take, and we were complaining about in our article, was to end the dense pack, what we call the dense packing of fuel in U.S. reactor pools.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that in a minute, but first I want to point out that the public thinks this is all taken care of, just like people in Japan thought their experts were completely in control of nuclear technology. American authorities, nuclear operators have known about this big risk from nuclear fuel pools for decades. Frank, why are you raising it again now?
Well, it's because, it's a good question why now, because, the politics right now in the United States aren't very favorable to new regulatory initiatives. There's an administration in that wants to reduce the amount of regulation. And in fact, just today they had hearings on nominations for 3 out of the 5 members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And they're all skeptics of concerning regulations. They want to have a light touch. And so our proposal, which would cost $50 million per reactor, is something that the industry doesn't like, and the industry has a lot of sway over the regulators in the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission right now.
Well, I have to tell you, in previous interviews, experts from the Union of Concerned Scientists told me the NRC has a long history of waiting years to make safety regulations, and then they give nuclear reactor operators a lot more years to implement those changes. So I'm not surprised by what you're saying, but I want to get specific about what this $50 million a reactor could avoid. In the article in Science magazine, there's a graphic map showing possible areas covered by the radioactive plume if a spent fuel fire happened at the Peach Bottom nuclear power plant. That's in Pennsylvania. If the fire happens in January, it looks like Philadelphia becomes red hot and New York City gets a dose that could be survivable. The same accident in April is a massive disaster, spreading hot contamination up and down the East Coast. But a fall fire takes the danger west towards Virginia, Kentucky, and even Ohio. Frank, why such a big difference in the seasons of when an accident happens?
I'm not sure it's the seasons. What we did was we did 12 calculations for a release starting on the first day of each month. And so there is a lot of variation in weather, wind direction, and so on. And it's not necessarily a question of season. It can depend on whether there's rain or not, bringing down the radioactivity that's in the atmosphere. That area of contamination to the northeast of the Fukushima plant was brought down by rain, actually.
Well, I've heard that the Japanese just got lucky and that the prevailing winds took the radioactivity, about 9/10 of it, right out into the Pacific instead of right over Japan.
That's right. It's on the east coast, and the prevailing winds are offshore.
Well, it's like a nuclear casino there. Now, is there a chance that a major city like New York, Baltimore, or even Washington, D.C., would have to be evacuated entirely if there was a spent fuel fire at just one reactor somewhere in the east?
There is a chance, and we calculated that, after correcting some NRC calculations, that on average, 8 million people would have to be relocated. It could go up. It could be much higher than that. That's just an average number. And what we're concerned is not the radiation levels killing people outright, but increasing their risk of cancer to an unacceptable level. And the EPA has set a threshold for the annual dose that in their view would justify relocation, and that our maps are based on that dose.
Would some areas or possibly even a city have to remain abandoned, like the land around Chernobyl, or could the radioactivity eventually be cleaned up, as they're trying to do in Fukushima City?
Yeah, the luck with cleaning up hasn't been so great. You know, in Fukushima, the best they've been able to do is to reduce the radiation level by a factor of 3. So in areas marginally contaminated, you could do that. I think, of course, you'd put Fukushima, the contamination is mostly, we're not talking about big cities. We're talking about towns and really a lot of open land. And so there would be a much more major effort, intense effort, if, for example, we're talking about a city like Washington or New York. But I think some painful decisions would have to be made, about whether maybe rather than abandon all that high cost buildings, whether people would decide that they would be willing to tolerate a somewhat higher cancer risk.
More people would die sooner is what it boils down to. I know that California ratepayers had to pay an additional levy to decommission nuclear power plants at the end of their operation period. But who pays for the damages if a nuclear fuel storage facility catches fire?
Well, the industry is required to have a collective insurance pool. And at the moment, that totals $13.6 billion. But if you're talking about $2 trillion, like, which is our estimate of the average cost of a spent fuel fire in a dense packed pool, then basically the 99% of the cost would be on the taxpayers. Or on the people, on the people who have to abandon their property.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is physicist Frank von Hippel from Princeton. We're talking about the unimaginable risk if a fire erupts at a nuclear fuel storage facility at any reactor, as detailed in a new article in Science magazine. The Mark I GE design reactors have the dangerous situation of storing some nuclear fuel in the reactor building, essentially above the reactor itself. The 4 blown reactors in Fukushima all had that design, as you know. Some of the reactors of the same type are still operating in the U.S. I think it's around 20 or so, despite those known flaws. Have the American Mark I reactors been made any safer to avoid the same issues as happened in Japan?
They haven't, really. In Japan, they are. I mean, there are other issues besides the elevated spent fuel pool. It turns out that other reactors, even when they have their pools at ground level, many of them can partially drain. There's cavities below them, or maybe a wall is exposed above grade. So, but there are other issues with the GE Mark I, II reactors that you're talking about, and one of them, which we saw in Fukushima, was that the volumes of the containments around the reactors are much smaller than typical for other types of reactors. That issue is an issue that a colleague and I and other people have raised in the 70s after Three Mile Island. And we suggested that if you get into a situation, which actually happened at Fukushima, where that containment gets overpressured, that there be a system where you can release the pressure through a filter system so that the radioactivity is mostly kept inside the building. Most countries, actually, in most of Europe, basically Western Europe, adopted that recommendation. The U.S. and Japan didn't. Now Japan is doing that. That's another lesson from Fukushima that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looked at. It estimated it would cost the utilities $15 million, and they decided not to ask them to spend that money.
Now, if the fuel rods that you mentioned are all jammed into pools beyond their original design intention, does that make a nuclear fire more likely or worse if it happens?
It makes not necessarily more likely, but definitely worse. And first of all, there's more fuel to burn, but something else which the NRC has actually found, we hadn't thought of it, was it makes a hydrogen explosion more likely. What happens in the early stages of the uncovery is that steam reacts with a hot metal cladding, and the H2O, the O basically goes in and makes an oxide with the metal cladding, and the H2 then becomes free hydrogen. And in the case of a dense packed pool, the NRC staff found that enough hydrogen would be developed so you would have a explosion that would blow the building open, which is actually what happened at Fukushima, although the hydrogen in that case was from the reactor's cores. And if you have a building blown away, then if there is a fire, all the radioactivity gets released into the open air. Whereas if you don't have a hydrogen explosion, which is what the NRC staff concluded that you would not have if you followed the recommendation that they rejected, the building would remain intact and most of the radioactivity would plate out on the inside of the building.
Well, I think it's always a good idea to avoid an explosion at a nuclear storage site. I'll go with you that far. Now, there is a safer option, I think, that I've heard about, which is the dry cask storage. Do you think that's safer?
Yes, and in fact, that's what we recommend, and that's what the NRC considered. Basically, after a few years, the NRC was considering 5 years. After 5 years of cooling in water, you can remove the fuel and put it in air-cooled casks. And that was the original plan design of the pools was that they were only going to have fuel in there for a few years and then it was going to be removed. But when what they were going to do with this fuel off-site, that plan was canceled. Then the utilities put more and more fuel into the pools until they're packed about as densely as the reactor cores. That means that they could go critical, and therefore they have to put each fuel assembly inside a box with neutron-absorbing walls. And that's what makes it a dense-packed fuel, if the water level drops and uncovers it, so difficult to cool in one of these accident situations.
How long can those fuel pools be maintained safely if the electric grid goes down for any reason?
Well, it's a slowly developing accident, and what was remarkable about Fukushima was for how long, you know, the situation was out of control. It was for about a month at the site. It takes on that order of length of time for the water to boil down if it's not replenished, for the spent fuel to become uncovered. The other scenario, which the NRC thought that was incredible that could happen here, and they didn't even consider such a scenario where things would be out of control for so long. So they considered scenarios where an earthquake would cause the pool to crack and drain, which would be, and they considered scenarios in which within a day or so the fuel would be uncovered.
Hmm. Are the American dry cask designs prepared for a terrorist attack, and are they as good as the German design?
Well, there are a variety of designs, and the German design, I think, that you're thinking about is a very thick-walled cast iron cask, whereas the American design is a thin-walled steel canister and then surrounded by a radiation shield of reinforced concrete. I prefer the German design myself, but I think either is much safer than leaving the fuel in the pool in a dense pack configuration.
So why doesn't the NRC mandate the transfer to dry casks be done right now?
Well, because they calculated it would cost $50 million, and they figured the probability, and so they did a cost-benefit analysis. And the cost-benefit analysis was first to estimate the consequences, and then multiply by the probability, and then compare that with the cost. And they took an arbitrary probability, which included not taking into account the possibility of a terrorist attack, and they underestimated the consequences, and on that basis, they concluded that the benefit in terms of the probability multiplied times the consequences would be less than the $50 million per pool that would cost the utilities to move early to fuel to earlier than they have to fuel to dry cask storage.
Well, you mentioned terrorism. I know reactor buildings are supposed to be hardened to withstand an attack by crash landing an aircraft. It's my understanding that spent fuel ponds, however, which contain far more radioactive material, are not hardened in that way. True?
The pools themselves are quite robust, but the building above them is a very lightweight building, so that there would certainly be nothing to prevent an aircraft from crashing into a pool.
And is there any possibility the computer systems which operate and monitor those spent fuel tanks could be hacked as cyber warfare or in a terrorist attack?
Could be. It's less of a concern than what the consequences would be for a reactor, because the time scale for a reactor is going without cooling is a matter of minutes before you get into trouble with a meltdown, whereas for a pool, it's really a matter of days. So hacking is less of a concern for the pool.
Okay. Now, if a terrorist attack struck an on-site nuclear fuel, would it be the same thing as a fuel fire for any other reason, like an accident, or might an explosion spread radioactivity further?
I think the concern, fire in a drained pool is sort of like a worst case already. Mm-hmm. And so terrorists, the concern about terrorists is that they might be able to cause that, the NRC didn't consider that, but they considered the possibility of an earthquake causing that. But it would be a similar event, however it was caused.
Dr. von Hippel, what do you think of the temporary nuclear fuel parking lot proposed for West Texas?
Well, this is a proposal to transport fuel in casks down and basically park them one scenario would be just on a concrete pad in that area. I don't see, for spent fuel at an operating nuclear power plant, I don't see the point, because you can do that equally well at the reactor site. We have an increasing number of reactors which are being shut down, and then after a while, all you have is spent fuel and dry casks, and there is a point to consolidating that in one place so you can have an adequate security.
Well, I'm shocked but not surprised that the new administration will appoint people who don't like regulations to the NRC. But if you were called to advise the President or Congress, what priority recommendations would you and your colleagues make?
In this current case, I understand their reluctance to ask the nuclear utilities to make additional expenditures at a time when a number of these nuclear power plants can't compete with wind and natural gas. And therefore, we recommended that actually, if Congress is actually already paying for these dry casks, when the spent fuel is transferred, when the pools are absolutely jam-packed and you can't put any more, and you need to put more in because the reactor is discharging it, you take out the oldest 25-year-old spent fuel and put it into dry cask. We're already paying for that. And so I would recommend that we actually pay for doing that earlier and get get out of this situation. The other recommendation we make is that in some states, so far, New York, and are actually subsidizing uneconomic nuclear power plants to keep them open. And a minor part of that subsidy would be sufficient to pay for this earlier, what the NRC calls expedited transfer of spent fuel from pools to dry casks. And so the states could require that. They don't have any authority to impose safety regulations on nuclear power plants, but if they're giving money, then that gives them leverage to make a quid pro quo.
Well, as we wrap up, Frank, you are from a famous family of scientists and educators. You've written books for the public about nuclear risks. You were an assistant director for national security in the Clinton White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. You've been at this for at least 5 decades. Does it frustrate you that humans just can't seem to rise up to the responsibility of having and using nuclear technology?
It is frustrating. You know, I've spent most of my time worrying about nuclear weapons, where the risk is even greater. We do make progress now and then, and I just hope the question is whether we're making fast enough progress, and we'll only know with time whether in fact we've taken actions in time that we really should to make this a safer world.
We'll know if we survive it.
Right.
We've been talking with Dr. Frank von Hippel. He's a nuclear expert, policy advisor, author, and a senior research physicist at Princeton Program on Science and Global Security. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Frank, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The American coal industry is dying, thank goodness, even as coal baron Robert Murray sues TV host John Oliver for telling him so. Trump promises to bring back coal, but he can't. But elsewhere, in Australia, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has reversed himself on global warming and now calls, incredibly, for new coal-burning power plants. I guess he missed the fires and the heat waves and the droughts and the floods. India is counting on coal power for its billion people. China continues to burn mountains of coal every day. Even green-talking Germany continues to burn coal. It's like nobody heard the science, the news, or the weather reports. It's like humans do not believe their own sweating bodies. The atmosphere and the seas are the new invaders. As Clive Hamilton says, this is the dawn of the defiant Earth. Maybe we can't stop this now, but can we at least sound the alarm and head for the lifeboats instead of going down with the ship? That will be my new mission when I return with new Radio EcoShock shows this coming September. In the meantime, I'm going to comb through my 11 years of interviews to bring you the fundamentals and the cutting edges you might have missed. Please tune in again next week. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about the future.